Succession number 26803, Reel 2.
George Co, Reel 1. Can I start by asking you when you were born and where that was? So you're saying about the discipline. George Co, Reel 2. So you learnt to operate this equipment?
Yes.
How long did that take?
What?
To learn how to operate it.
To look to the course?
Yes.
Probably 3 to 4 weeks.
And what happened to you after that?
After that? There was no examination of any sort. We just finished the course. And once again, the secrecy was drilled into us because radar was quite new for airborne radar. But we were then told that because you'd done this course, ASV, you would be posted to a training unit of Coastal Command. So from that point, I went up to RAF Thornaby in Yorkshire, and there we continued with our operational training, OTU, and there we met up with the rest of our crew, a pilot who was British, navigator, observer, who was a Canadian, and 2 wireless operator air gunners, British. And so we started our airborne training. First of all, we did basic exercises for the normal radar or wireless operating. We joined with the pilot, navigator. We kept with him for circuits and landings, day, night, whatever, until he reached the required standard, and we reached the required standard. Sometimes the crew would be interchangeable, so move from one crew to another, and this took place on with Hudson aircraft. They were the leased aircraft from America. The Hudson aircraft, I have a photograph if you want to see one, but Hudson aircraft was equipped with forward firing machine guns, a rear gunner, which was, he was housed in a bubble that was stuck in the top of the fuselage. Because this aircraft was twin fins, so it didn't have a very good range of fire. The angle was sort of somewhat limited. Anyway, we did these various runs, basic radio, radar, and then navigation exercises around the country, over the North Sea, and so on. There really wasn't much to say about this, except we just kept on and on with these exercises and that, and then come to the end of the course. And the final flight was to be our sort of passing out. So we all got together, the crew, and that was going to be our... So early one morning, there I was. Radio equipment was very basic at the time. The radio receiver worked on a high-tension battery, 120 volts high tension battery, and also a 1.5 volt accumulator which could be charged after each flight. The transmitter, once again, was a huge box-like thing which, when you switched it on, the valves would glow and illuminate the whole of the cockpit. And on top of the receiver was a little stub on which was mounted a ball bearing. Now, in those days, to receive a Morse signal, you had to have two signals coming in which would heterodyne with each other and produce an audible note that you could hear in the earphones. And the only way you could tell whether this thing was working, you had to wet your finger and tap the top of this ball bearing, and you would hear it bleep, and you would adjust your reaction control, as they called it, to get the audible note. So, anyway, having to describe roughly the radio equipment, then we went our different ways for briefing. The pilot navigator would go and get the weather information, that sort of thing. And I would go over to the hangar, the battery section, and pick up my battery that was just being charged. So there I was, I had my parachute in one hand, and I had the battery in the other hand. And the chap who was doing the battery said, "Right, your next place is over in that corner of the hangar." So I went over to the corner of the hangar. I had no clue what it was all about. And there was a big cage, and the battery man said, "You go over there to pick up your pigeon." And that was our third line of communication. And there was a pigeon, my pigeon, in a little container with a little tube of water and a little packet of bird seed. And so I picked him up and off we toddled and climbed in the aircraft, various checks, and then we were away. The object of the pigeon was that in case we, first of all, for emergency purposes, if we came down, you could write your position on the message slip and send off the pigeon. But the alternative was that if your radio went dead or you were out of range and you suddenly saw a battleship in the Norwegian Fjord, then you could send your pigeon back, okay? So anyway, off we went. We did our exercise. We went to a point just off the Skagerrak. That is that strip of water between Norway and Denmark. And so we went there, we did our exercise, sent a dummy sighting report, and then on the final bit coming in, then we used the radar to home onto the beacon, and so that was it. So I'll stop for a moment there. Anyway, having finished our operational training, we were posted to squadrons. And I was posted with the crew to a squadron based in Iceland. So we picked up our aircraft, which we were to take to Iceland, and we did a couple of cold weather trials. We were equipped with cold weather equipment, anti-icing fluid on the wings and etc. And so,
which squadron did you join? Which squadron did you join?
Oh, I think the number was 269, but I never got there. We did these cold weather trials with our aircraft, and everything, oh, embarkation leave. So we all went our different ways. At this time, of course, the Battle of the Atlantic was hotting up. And we went our different ways, and I was home on leave. And I went to the pictures round the corner. We were halfway through the main film, and suddenly the lights went up, and they put a slide on the screen. By this time, incidentally, I was a sergeant. Having finished my aircrew training, you became a sergeant. On the screen appeared, will Sergeant Coe report to the box office? So anyway, I went back home, went to the box office, and apparently the pilot had received instructions that our posting to us and was cancelled. We were now to proceed to West Africa. So, we started all over again. We picked up our aircraft, flew it around, had our leave, changed our cold weather clothing for tropical uniform, and off we went from an airfield in Cornwall down the south. From an airfield in Cornwall down to the south, and off we went to Gibraltar. And having arrived at Gibraltar, a couple of days there, filled in the long range tanks, and then we were on our way down the bulge of Africa to the Gambia.
When was this exactly? What year are we talking
about? What year? This was 1940, beginning of 1942.
So you arrived in the Gambia?
Arrived at the Gambia. Now, one wondered, of course it was all part of the war in the Atlantic, U-boats and that sort of thing, but apparently, at the time, Gambia was surrounded by the French, the Vichy French. They were sort of aligned with Hitler, Vichy French, you see. And so they were, in fact, our enemy. And so the object was to, incidentally, the capital was Dakar. Now, in the harbour at Dakar was the French battleship, the Admiral Richelieu. Now, it was important at that time to keep that battleship in port until the Navy could get to it, because you didn't want that out in the Atlantic with the convoys. In fact, so we did daily patrols across the harbour at Dakar, and at the same time did convoy escort to the convoys going down the Cape, round and up to Cairo. And
were you on anti-submarine operations, really? Were you on anti-U-boat operations?
We were, yes.
That was your main task.
We were doing U-boat ops. Yes, and we used our ASV for detection purposes.
Did you come across any? Did you come across any U-boats?
Well, we did pick up one in the North Sea couple of years later, but we weren't sure whether that was one of ours or one of theirs. Yeah. Anyway, so, but you see, the thing was that by this time, the Germans had built their own anti-detection devices. So as we were transmitting from our aircraft, radar pulses. The Germans would be listening to him and picking them up. So they knew we were coming anyway. So there were many times when we arrived over we thought to be a submerged U-boat. It could be a shoal of fish, porpoises, and penguin, those sort of things. And so that was it. We dropped depth charges, yes. I mean, there were submarines there because later we learned that one of our aircraft, piloted by a New Zealander called Trigg, he'd come across a U-boat in the South Atlantic. It was on the surface, so he attacked it, and the U-boat fired back. The end result was the U-boat was sunk, but the aircraft was shot down. The U-boat commander had made his report, and as a result of all this, the pilot, who was now posthumous, he was awarded the Victoria Cross. So we carry on now with our work from the Gambia.
What was life like living in the Gambia? What was it like living in West Africa?
Well, we were living in the jungle. We got to Gambia, and there they carved out a strip, typical of what you might see on television, a strip. They pulled out the trees, and there we had a long strip with trees either side. The actual runway itself consisted of metal planks called PSP, which stood for perforated steel planking. These were all joined together. And as you took off or landing on this, it sounded like corrugated iron roof. So, anyway, we had a grass hut for the side, which was our control tower. The whole of just one run, one airstrip, alongside were trenches dug, just in case, because of the Vichy French. And eventually, we moved out of that airstrip and went to a more permanent aerodrome, which was being built. That airstrip was called Jezwang, and the new airport, which I think might have become the international airport of today, was called Yumdum. However, there was two or three of our aircraft at Gambia, but the squadron began to expand. And more aircraft arrived, and eventually Sunderland squadron arrived in the harbour, and eventually we expanded to the point where we had detachments at Freetown, Sierra Leone, and round to the Gold Coast, as it was called now Ghana, and then to Nigeria. So we really had a string of bases around the hump of Africa, where we used to go to and from these places, and so that was it.
What squadron were you part of?
200 squadron.
And what were your working patterns like? How often were you airborne?
Oh, well, if I got my flying logbook out, which I look, it's in the top cupboard, I think, Margaret. Working patterns. Well, we just had a crew roster, which would appear on the notice board in the crew room. That was it. You just looked at there was no leave at that time. You just looked at this roster, and you might find you were bound for Sierra Leone the next day. I don't know. Sometimes, I mean, I was woken up in the middle of the night by a military policeman who said, "Oh, they want you for a flight in 2 hours." And that, I mean, it was just like that. There was a roster. Every now and again, you would get a day off, but invariably, you just carried on. Now,
what did you do for entertainment? What did you do in your free time?
Usually sat in the mess and had a drink beer, although there wasn't much beer available. There was not much to do. Walk around the local area. Used to do a lot of swimming. They provided a truck, and we used to go to the Atlantic Ocean and spend a couple of hours there. There was no sort of social facilities of any sort. Wasn't even a canteen or anything like that. It was all very basic.
I was
living in a tent at the time. So do you want to stop for a moment there and look at this or not?
No, it's okay.
I'll leave it till you finish.
Yeah, that's fine, unless you want to refer to it for any reason. Do you want to look at it?
No. And so, anyway, the tour of duty in West Africa was 500 hours flying or 12 months. And I finished, it's all right. There we are. 200 squadron. By that time, I'd done 482 hours. 482 hours, and just about 12 months. So I was determined, I was said to be tour expired, and so we flew down to Freetown to pick up our boat, the Queen Mary, as it was said at the time. On the way down, though, we had engine failure. We were up to Lobbin somewhere. By the time we got to Freetown, the Queen Mary had gone. So we had to kick our heels around until the next available boat came in, which turned out to be one of these old-time colonial boats where they took civil servants out to the various colonies and came back. And we were put on one of these boats. And the boat was chock-a-block with bodies. We were sleeping in hammocks just above the mess deck. So there was the mess deck where you had your meals. And then when night came, you got your hammock out and slung it up above. And that was our sleeping quarters. We were all huddled together in a very limited space. Anyway, after 2 or 3 weeks, we arrived back at Liverpool. So that was the end of my first tour.
How had you kept in contact with your family whilst you'd been away?
How what?
How did you keep in contact with your family?
Just letter, censored. You weren't allowed to say where you were or what you were doing. You wrote a letter and that was censored before it was put in the post.
Did you find it difficult coping with the climate whilst you were in West Africa?
Yeah, the climate. Personally, I didn't have any problems at all. I picked up the usual foot rot, which was caused by having showers with boards which were infested, you know. But rest of my crew went down with malaria. Other air crews picked up black water fever and all those sort of nasties, you see. And the chap, our pilot, went in hospital with malaria, and he came out again after 2 or 3 weeks, and he went back on flying again. Of course, all this time we were taking medication, mepocrine and quinine, those sort of things. In fact, when you sat down to your meal, there was a dish of these tablets on the table. You just help yourself. anyway, we get to the point when I'm now back at home, disembarkation leave now at Liverpool, and I then got my poster notice to report to RAF Squires Gate at Blackpool. So we're back again. So
when was this?
When was it?
Yes.
This will be in July of 1943.
Blackpool?
Well, this was what they called in the RAF days a rest. So you did your tour on the squadron and then you did something else. Now, for my rest, I was a radio instructor flying around the Irish Sea in Anson's. And there I used to listen to what my student was doing and guide him along the right way to qualify as a radio op. And this went on. We had a simple roster system. We were either doing morning plus afternoon or evening and night. So that was our roster. On the morning shift, 3 hours roughly around the RSC, back to the mess. We were billeted in a hotel in the town in the Blackpool. So what they did was they issued us with bicycles. So when we were due on, we cycled up to the aerodrome. Then when we finished, we're back again. So we had all our meals. This hotel became a sergeant's mess. And so we go to and from, okay, sometimes on a Saturday, day off a week or something like that. Leave every few weeks, we might get a week's leave, and so on. And so, that's it. Any questions now?
How long did that last?
How long did that last? February 1944. February, March 1944. So,